And now, the Great American Folk Show, a little place on the radio where we commune with you to share stories, sing songs, and talk to some good people with great voices. Stay with us over the next hour as we bring you musician and actor John Doe, North Dakota poet Madeline Kamrud, musicians Sarah and Sean Watkins, New York Times bestselling author Daniel Levitin, plus freelance writer and arts educator Julie Wolfson on Gefilte Fish. I'm Joe Wiegand. Good to have you with us on Prairie Public. Here's your host, Tom Brousseau.
Kathy Lowry from Nashville, Tennessee, wrote in with a song request after hearing the premiere of the Great American Folk Show in May. "Play a John Prine song," she writes, "and I mean you, and I don't care what John Prine song you sing. Just make sure it's a John Prine song, because right about now, I'm in the mood for a good country number." Well, you got it, Kathy from Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for listening, and thanks for writing in. John Prine was a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, originally from Maywood, Illinois, but resided in Nashville, Tennessee. He began releasing albums in the early 1970s. His lyrics are heartfelt, honest, and oftentimes humorous. He recorded a famous and fun duet with singer-songwriter Iris DeMent in the 1990s, and it was a big hit, entitled In Spite of Ourselves. It goes a little something like this. "She thinks all my jokes are corny. Convict movies make her horny. She likes ketchup on her scrambled eggs. She swears like a sailor when she shaves her legs. She takes a lickin' and keeps on tickin'. I'm never gonna let her go." John Prine survived cancer, but in April of this year, he passed away due to complications caused by COVID-19. He was 73 years old. He touched a lot of people with his music, and because of that, he was beautiful. John Prine will be greatly missed. Well, here's that John Prine song I promised. It's entitled, "Yes, I Guess They Ought to Name a Drink After You."
All we do is fight. That's why I go out every night. The more I drink, the less I feel blue. Sometimes I feel like an awful fool, spending my life on an old bar stool. Yes, I guess they ought to name a drink after you. I don't know how my heart will mend if this is really the end. It's gonna take a lot to make it through. You left my heart a vacant lot. I'll fill it in with another shot. Yes, I guess they ought to name a drink after you. And I should just go pay my bill when I begin Somebody told me you left town, and here I am with another round. Yes, I guess they ought to name a drink after you. I don't know how my heart will mend if this is really the end. It's gonna take a lot to make it through. You left my heart a vacant lot. I'll fill it in with another shot. Yes, I guess they ought to name a drink after you. Yes, I guess they ought to name a drink after you. Yes, I guess they ought to name a drink after you.
Madeline Camrude is the author of three poetry publications. This House is Filled with Cracks, New Rivers Press, 1994. Oddly Beautiful, New Rivers Press, 2013, and Songs of Horses and Lovers, North Dakota State University Press, 2018, plus the chapbook The Light We Go After, Minnesota State University Moorhead, 2006. Several of her poems were read by Garrison Keillor on Writer's Almanac. Sometimes I like to look at customer reviews on literature and poetry. Usually they're thoughtfully written and have a lot of heart. Of the many 5-star customer reviews and comments Madeline's work has received over the years, this one seems to speak for the whole lot of them. 5 stars, pulls at the heart, a wonderful personal journey. It touches you to the core. Here's Madeline Camrude with 3 poems.
This is a poem called Dakota Pasture. In the spring when calves burst onto rings of steaming grass, I stood in the pasture knowing everything about living. All I wanted to do would surely happen. Cows licked sacks and blood while the coulee overflowed a dam of rocks piled to save it for summer. Water gorged sod on its way to the red, flattening fences, filling ditches, turned fields into mirrors, losing their silver. The smell of silage fermented all winter, grew rich in the hill pit where cows gnawed and chewed its thawed edges. One early Easter, my sister went wading in the coulee, icy water no higher than her knees. Her hair done for church took the wind in its curls. She was prettier than most, her curves soft under a dress. Pneumonia came in 3 days, gray cough and high temperature nearly killing her. But she survived like the rest of us girls with no brothers, a father in the fields, and a mother too busy to touch. 1 mile farther past the mailbox, there were cousins who had front zippers. They taught us something about differences, about being in this pasture, squared by ditches, filled with water in spring, where green took a hue of great intensity. I saw it always with no talk of love. I go back to the edge of that washout where I stand, looking in, hoping for something to hold. This is a poem in memory of my mother. It's called Reflection. If mother hadn't walked half a land section to school and back, those days of sewer wind, icy cold and snow, and if she, who spoke only Norwegian, hadn't learned enough English to win the spelldowns, if so many good things like that hadn't happened, would I have imagined some kind of heaven when clouds broke through and sun shone today? I clear away winter's dead sticks. sure that buds on branches will open for a spring I haven't yet seen. Grasses blanched white will green again. Spring will warm us, and I'll forget grief. Blackened fields will take fresh seed. Clouds gray singing the blues in corn stubble all winter will roll away and break into midsummer jazz. Through it all, I'll put my trust in the lone tree, the one that stands in the middle of the field. No one knows how it got there, but there is where it stays, straight and tall, centered in all kinds of weather. This is a poem about a senior couple, moments after the children and grandchildren have gone home. The poem's entitled, So Little Remains. Times like this, after supper, dishes done, everyone gone home. We vacate to the sofa and sit, not talking. If you look at this picture and you don't know better, you might think we are unhappy. How could you know his shoulder touching mine? Might not have noticed how he leaned close and kissed me high, near my ear, his kiss no more than a whisper.
There's a black horse in the photograph, his mane blows in your face. There's a black horse in the photograph, his mane blows in your face. Your eyes are hidden, will you be taken away? Black and white feathers blow across the lawn. Black and white feathers blow across the lawn. The dog sleeping on them, the scaffold is already done. Feel like I could live forever. Forever hasn't happened yet. The shadow of blackbirds, as many as in a pie. The shadow birds, as many as baked in a pie, passes over your burning head as you prepare to die.
Sarah and Sean Watkins grew up playing bluegrass music together, where they were born, in Vista, a hilly, peaceful Southern California community of about 100,000 people. They joined the show with a few reminiscences and three songs from their new Watkins Family Hour album entitled Brother Sister.
I remember growing up in North San Diego County, in Vista, very agricultural, equestrian, and we started going to that pizza place because Sean was playing piano and the piano teacher said, you should go see my son's band play, Bluegrass Etc. They play every Saturday night.
That's right. My piano teacher's son's name was John Moore, and he was the front man of a 3-piece bluegrass band called Bluegrass Etc. that had a weekly show every Saturday night for 6 or 7 years at a place in Carlsbad, California called That Pizza Place.
In Southern California, it's really common for bluegrass to happen in pizza parlors. I think it's the cheap food and the pitchers of soda. And I remember falling asleep there on the very long pizza parlor benches when I was, you know, 2 or 3. And we started hanging out with the band and getting to know the other people who would come and watch them play. And they became good friends of ours. And we eventually started taking lessons from the band members.
That's right. I started taking mandolin lessons from John Moore, who was my piano teacher's son. I wanted to play guitar first, but my hands were apparently too small, so I was advised by John to start on mandolin and then switch to guitar later on once my hands had grown. And it was around that time that we met our future bandmate, Chris Thiele. He was 5, Sarah was 5 at the time, and I was 9. And we became good friends. Chris was taking lessons from John Moore as well, and then Sarah started taking lessons from the fiddle player in that band, Dennis Kaplinger.
Yeah, and before I started taking fiddle lessons, John invited me to come on stage. I requested a song called Long Black Veil, and he said, all right, but you have to sing it. And I said, well, I only know the chorus. So he had me up to sing the chorus, and I remember being a very short 4-year-old singing into his mandolin mic. It's on a shorter stand, and it's only needs to be a couple feet off the ground or a few feet. And I remember singing into that and feeling like the stage was so tall.
I went back to That Pizza Place recently, and the stage is gone, but I do remember it being about a foot tall.
It's not a tall stage.
Not a tall stage.
And very early on, we were just sitting in with them every once in a while. They would have us up to play tunes. And I remember learning that if I ordered an ice cream cone after sitting in with them, that there was a chance I would get that ice cream cone for free. But if I ordered the ice cream cone before sitting in, I had to shell out that dollar.
Yep. So, yeah, growing up playing bluegrass in Southern California might seem like a contradiction, but there's a little pocket of bluegrass kind of wherever you look. And the people that are into bluegrass or any sort of roots music that's generally less popular than what's being played on the radio, the people that are into that kind of music, they find each other, and scenes definitely seem to appear. And that was definitely the case for us in Carlsbad, California, at That Pizza Place.
The scene really revolved around that band, Bluegrass Etc.
It also was very fun looking back, you know, hearing stories from our parents and our parents' friends that were in the audience, how funny it was hearing Sarah sing the final verse of Long Black Veil, which is what, Sarah?
Well, the scaffold was high and eternity near. She stood in the crowd and shed not a tear. While I spoke not a word, that what meant my life, I'd been in the arms of my best friend's wife.
Just picture that being sung by a little 5-year-old Sarah Watkins.
promised land. All the sorrow and the pain here is greater than the miles of desert. Children will be free. Oh, my sister, come and take my hand, and we'll walk together till we reach that promised land. All the pain we left behind us is greater. Thank you.
long as everything stays the same. I avoided the cure, but it found me anyway. I was looking for a redo, but my game hadn't changed. And hoping for a different outcome is insane. This is good, this is real, it's how it's supposed to feel. Right here and now, both feet planted on the ground. I've been praying for a breakthrough, as long as everything stays the same. I avoided the cure, but it found me anyway. Sometimes you gotta break down and throw everything away. Take a look at it all, it's a curtain call of yesterday's. Now and then you gotta leave town and you're zero sum.
You're listening to The Great American Folk Show on Prairie Public.
Our next guest is Julie Wolfson, a freelance writer and arts educator in Los Angeles, California. She covers everything from fashion to cocktails to travel and writes for publications such as Cool Hunting, The LAist, and The Los Angeles Times. I kind of gave her a little bit of a writing assignment. I asked her to share a reflection on her connection with a traditional fish dish, and I'm so glad that she accepted because I think you're all going to really love what she has to say. It is an honor to have Julie Wolfson on the show.
Gefilte fish, one Jewish mom's journey to learn about this beige blob and why we eat it. Fish has been thought of as a symbol of fertility in the Jewish tradition. In the Old Testament, Jacob gave his children blessings that they should multiply like fish in the sea. It was customary for Jews to eat fish on Friday night. An old Yiddish story tells of a Rebbe who believed he smelled the odor of paradise when his wife cooked fish on Shabbat. Now, many would first think of smoked salmon on a bagel as the fish associated with Jewish traditions and celebrations. There's another fish dish that goes back centuries and takes its place on the Passover Seder table. I'm talking about gefilte fish. My family origins trace back to my great-grandparents in Odessa. My grandfather, George Baker, left Odessa as a young man, found work in Shanghai for several years, and made his way to San Francisco. My mother, Joyce, was raised in San Francisco as George's oldest American dream child. She was not taught a word of Russian and grew up in a house with little to no Russian food. When she married my father and had my brother and I, the food was a very 70s and 80s American diet of hamburgers and chicken breasts and head lettuce salads. On Passover, my mom would buy a jar of gefilte fish from the supermarket, open it up, and plate each one on china with the obligatory slice of carrot. I would look at the fancied up blobs of fish and not eat it. Gefilte fish was the stuff of childhood nightmares. I was not the only kid who would cringe at the sight of it or dare a cousin to take a bite. As I grew up, this was all I knew of gefilte fish and did not think anything of it until I moved to LA to go to UCLA and after graduation met my husband, Stephen. His family, a blended and exuberant modern family of his mom's side from Texas and his stepfather's side from Southern California, would get together for massive family events. At least 50 would gather at his parents' house for Passover. My first Passover with them, I noticed the gefilte fish looked different. "Why are the gefilte fish pieces round?" I asked. "Oh, it's homemade by Grandma Adele," they said. I put one on my plate, sliced through it with my fork, and took a bite. "Oh," I thought, "now I get it. This tastes like a rustic fish quenelle or a pâté. This is a fish dish I understand." I learned that gefilte fish is a Yiddish word meaning stuffed or filled fish. This classic Ashkenazi Jewish recipe has origins in Poland, Germany, Lithuania, and Ukraine, and was made from finely chopped fish mixed with onion, eggs, matzo meal, and then poached in fish stock that was stuffed back into a deboned fish. Over the generations, the dish has evolved into this fish balls, usually an oval and a bit flattened. The next year, some of the women in the family joined Adele to learn how to make it. We headed to Linda's Santa Monica home, rolled up our sleeves. That day I discovered that making gefilte fish is a time-consuming process of making fish stock from the fish heads, mixing the chopped fish concoction, poaching the fish balls, and opening up all the windows to help air out the fishy smell. Over the years, I have developed a taste for gefilte fish, though I must admit only the homemade version. Those jars at the grocery store still make me feel like a scared child. This year for Passover, we were home with our daughters during the COVID-19 stay-at-home order. To save me from running around town gathering up ingredients, we ordered Passover food from one of my favorite LA chefs, Michael Wexler. Along with his incredible matzo ball soup, beef brisket, potato kugel, he sent a tray of house-made gefilte fish. His take on his family's gefilte fish recipe was truly a delicious treat. This year for Passover, with my husband and two daughters, not the 20 or 50 family and friends we have often celebrated the holiday with, we read our version of the Haggadah on Zoom with family around the country. During dinner, our 16-year-old daughter Vivian looked around the table and said, "Please pass the gefilte fish." So I did, wondering what was going to happen. Vivian took a bite and said, "Hey, this is pretty good. I like it." I imagined my family in Odessa years ago shopping at the fishmonger. The journey my grandfather took from there as a young man to Shanghai and eventually landing in San Francisco to raise his family in California. The generations of our family that have joined in on the convenience of buying gefilte fish in a jar at the supermarket. And now I find myself surrounded by chefs and home cooks learning to make handmade varieties that honor this traditional old world way. So please join me in a toast to Adele and all of the grandmas out there who help us keep the traditions alive, even the chopped fish blob ones.
It was freshly shorn, and the moon was weak, and an empty street stretched out before him. He was 39 on December 10th, with a birthday 2 weeks away. The train went clickety-clickety beneath his feet, and his clothes didn't fit so good anymore. He could see his breath as he rode between the coach and the dining car. home seemed so far away, but he got there in less than half a day. He knew the world kept spinning all the time he was gone, but he couldn't say how it had changed. She talked to him quietly, and she looked him in the eye and said, "You can stay as long as you like." He smiled a little smile when she opened the window and let a little breeze inside. He split two cords of wood and he painted the fence, and he ate good food every day. She got him a job fixing cars for her uncle. He liked getting dirty, then getting clean. And when he laid down at night and held to a hand, he thought, "This is my sweet reward. This is my sweet relief. This is what I waited for. This is what I've been praying for."
We'd like to take a moment now and thank our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. Groceries, bakery, deli, floral, you name it. Hugo's, local and family-owned, serving 10 locations in North Dakota and Minnesota since 1939.
John Doe is a writer, actor, and musician. He's appeared in over 50 film and TV productions, to name a few movies, the cult classic Roadhouse, Georgia with Jennifer Jason Leigh and Mayor Winningham, and indie film Roadside Prophets with Adam Horovitz, also known as At-Rock from the Beastie Boys. He's best known as a founding member of the Los Angeles band X, who recently surprise-released their 8th studio album, Alphabet Land. John's a solo artist, too. That was him earlier singing songs that he composed, Sweet Reward and There's a Black Horse. We continue now with John Doe, a short story about a kid from a small Great Plains town with a lot of heart and his best friend. It's Mickey the dog.
My dog, Mickey, was bound to be special. He was born in January, outdoors, in sub-zero weather, under our neighbor's porch in North Dakota. He was the only pup in the litter, and the neighbors had never seen the mother or Mickey until the day he was born. I was 2 years old at the time, and my brother was one. My dad was just back from the war, World War II, and he and my mother adopted Mickey. We named him after a farm dog my mother's family had when she was a young girl. Mickey's mother ran off and was later shot by a farmer because she killed one of his sheep. We used to have a blurry snapshot of Mickey and his mother, taken on a winter day shortly after he was born, but I don't know what happened to it. I remember Mickey's mother as looking a lot like Mickey, with long black and white hair. Mickey grew up with my brother and me, and he was our constant companion. He was treated pretty much as an equal to the humans in our family. There were no leash laws back then, and all dogs roamed freely about town. Sure, some kids got nipped once in a while, but that would only happen if they were teasing or threatening the dog. We used to think that such kids had it coming. Mickey slept on his side on a braided rug in our little dining room. He seemed to have a lot of dreams, which would cause him to make faint whining sounds and move his legs as if he were running. He'd usually wake himself up from these dreams, and then he would seem to feel foolish for talking and running in his sleep. Mickey liked to play with us in the backyard. He followed us when we rode our bikes to the park. He never learned any dog tricks, but he did learn one skill, which I never knew any other dog to have. He could open doors. Pop put a little handle at the bottom of the screen doors to our house and my dad's barbershop. Mickey would put his paw on the handle, open the door a few inches, then put his nose inside the door and let himself in. My grandfather had a dog, Buster, who knew all kinds of tricks. Shake hands, roll over, tug of war. But Buster could never master the art of opening the screen door. He always had to rely on Mickey to let him inside. Buster was also good at starting fights with other dogs, but he relied on Mickey to finish his fights for him. Mickey saved Buster's life many times, and Buster never seemed to appreciate it. Mickey was a good fighter. We never knew him to lose a fight with another dog. All the other dogs in town gave him a wide berth. He was cock of the walk. One time, my dad's cousin came to town on a visit. He brought his dog with him, a big, black, mean-looking dog who wouldn't stop barking when he saw Mickey. The cousin said he would leave him in the car because he knew he would kill Mickey if he let him out. Pop told him to go ahead, let his dog out of the car. When he did, Mickey had that dog on his back within seconds, his neck between his jaws. The cousin had to put his dog back in the car to protect him from Mickey. There was no more barking after that. Being the cock of the walk in our town, Mickey had lots of liaisons with lady dogs. Our local priest had a nice-looking little poodle that Mickey took a liking to. The priest tried his best to keep the two apart, but one day he came home to find Mickey and the poodle alone in the house, in his upstairs bedroom yet. He cornered Mickey and took after him with a broom. In order to escape, Mickey jumped out of an upstairs window onto the porch roof, then down to the ground. The priest told us that before Mickey trotted off, he turned and barked twice, as if to acknowledge that he had accomplished his mission. Mickey liked to ride in the car. He preferred to sit in the front seat, and we usually let him do so. One time, my dad put him in the driver's seat, and then sat beside him and operated the car from the front passenger seat. They drove down Main Street, and many people saw them. Pop said Mickey could probably have driven without any help, because he was such a smart dog. One time, Mickey was shot in the abdomen by a neighborhood hoodlum. We could see the bullet hole in his side, and he lost a lot of blood. My dad and my brother and I took him to a vet about 20 miles away. I remember that Mickey was very quiet, lying in the back seat of the car during the trip. The vet told us there was nothing he could do, but that Mickey might survive because the guts are flexible. We never forgot his words. We took Mickey home then, and he licked his wound for a few days and drank a lot of water, and somehow he made a complete recovery. About a year before he died, Mickey had a stroke, which left him blind on his left side and quite feeble. He would still follow my dad to the barbershop every day, about 3 blocks from where we lived. Sometimes Pop would tell Mickey he had to stay home because he was too weak. Mickey seemed to understand, but he would often follow him anyway, just a little further behind than usual. One day, the train was coming through town. When Pop saw the train, he turned around and saw that Mickey was following about a block back. He did not see the train because it was on his blind side. The train and Mickey were on a collision course. Pop was afraid to call out to Mickey for fear that he would jump in front of the train. All he could do was watch. As it turned out, Mickey and the train arrived at the same point at the same time. The train bumped into the very tip of Mickey's nose, causing him to step back. Mickey waited for the train to pass. Then he resumed walking after my dad. Mickey got weaker and weaker after his stroke. He no longer followed my dad to work. He was content to stay home. One cold winter day, Pop came home to find Mickey frozen to the sidewalk, apparently from another stroke. However, he was still alive and wagged his tail when he saw my dad. Pop carried him into the house. That night, my parents decided that he had to be put to sleep. They called the local policeman who did the job and even buried Mickey, wrapped in my dad's army blanket, out back of our garden. He told my dad that it was like burying an old friend. Everyone liked Mickey. My brother and I were away at college when Mickey died. We cried when we heard he was gone. I know Mom and Pop felt terrible too. My dad always found understanding and comfort in the words of popular songs. When Mickey died, Pop reminded us of the song Old Shep, which ends with these words, "If dogs have a heaven, there's one thing I know. Old Mickey has a wonderful home."
You're listening to The Great American Folk Show on Prairie Public.
I first met Dr. Daniel Levitin in Storrs, Connecticut in 2012 at the Jorgensen Center for the Performing Arts when I was on tour with the Punch Brothers. I was selling my albums at the merchandise table after the show, and Daniel and his girlfriend Heather, who'd later become his wife, came up to say hi. The lobby was loud and dimly lit, but we still enjoyed a nice conversation. I remember they were kind people, and both of them had a nice smile. I didn't make the connection then that Daniel was the Daniel, whose books This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs I had read the year before as part of my summer list. I've got to say, I've met some interesting and talented people through music. But it's a thrill to meet someone who has changed your life through the art they've created. Dr. Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist, best-selling author, and a singer-songwriter. He joins us now to talk about an aspect of the writing process and then perform a brand new song he's composed, There Is Delight.
To write well, you have to love language. You have to really be in love with words and their various nuances. Breaking is not the same as smashing. Sadness is not the same as grief. The writer's job is to find the right words. Here's an example from a conversation I had with my friend Rodney Crowell a few days ago, who has taught me a lot about songwriting. As usual, I had been listening to a lot of Tom Brasseau music, and I heard a line that stuck with me, "Searching for sticks to make river rafts." I thought I could repurpose that into a different song, and this line popped in my head, which I shared with Rodney, "Searching for a stick to push the raft." I liked that. During the lockdown, many of us are feeling stuck. We're on the raft, but it's not going anywhere. Rodney asked, "Can you push a raft with a stick?" And he proposed, "Searching for a pole to push the raft." Then, "Searching for a pole to guide the raft." Guiding might be more interesting than pushing. Then he and I traded ideas, making the oar to guide the raft. Making is more active than searching, more interesting. Carving the oar to guide the raft, chiseling the oar, whittling the oar. We both liked chiseling. Whittling had too much of an old-timey sound to it. Chiseling sounded more like it could serve as a metaphor. This is how Rodney writes and why his songs stand up to repeated listenings. I still listen to and learn from songs he wrote 45 years ago. A colleague of mine asked for advice about writing books about science for a popular audience, and I said, you have to revise, revise, and revise again. Each of my own books went through at least 50 complete revisions before they were published. By the way, two of the best books I ever read were Becoming Leonardo and Life in Double Time, both written by Mike Lankford. I came to know Mike, and I asked him once how many drafts he wrote before publishing his books. 75, he said. And it shows. His are so much better than mine. I wrote a song called Johnny and Linda about a young woman in an abusive relationship who finally hits back and ends the cycle of violence. This was a line. Johnny came home drunk again, cursing up a storm. Rodney heard that and he said, he wouldn't be cursing, he'd be cussing. Cussing up a storm. Exactly right. As soon as I heard that, it felt true. A couple of months later, I played the song for my friend Livingston Taylor, who teaches songwriting at the Berklee College of Music and has written many, many great songs himself. Liv said, Johnny wouldn't come home drunk again. He'd come home whiskeyed up. The line became, Johnny came home whiskeyed up, cussing up a storm. Later in the song, I started a verse. Johnny broke the window. Livingston said, he didn't break the window. He busted out the window. So now it's Johnny busted out the window. That rings true. It's using speech in a way that's consistent with the character and story I'm building. Liv and I went out for lunch, and when we came back, he looked at it again and he said, I'm not sure the window is personal enough to Linda. It's not what will set her off and get her to fight back. How about Johnny smashed the family picture? Again, as soon as I heard it, it sounded like it had to be that way all along. The whole song has 44 lines. Rodney and Liv changed two of them, and it made a huge difference to the story. I sing it with more confidence now. In one of my newest songs, There Is Delight, the chorus starts, All that came before us is just light, and so despite the pleas and pleasantries, we claim the night. I learned from listening to John Lennon and to Rodney Crowell that the chorus doesn't need to be exactly the same each time you sing it. You can change a word here and there. I realized I could try that here. The second time the chorus comes in, I revised the line to, And so despite the pleas and pleasantries, we take the night. And the third chorus became, We forge the night. So now there's a progression as the song moves forward. First we claim it, then we take it, then we forge it. I think it adds interest, and it moves the story forward. You have to love language. I recommend that writers get to know other writers to bounce ideas off of each other. And revise, revise, revise. I'm learning to chisel the oar to guide my raft.
There is delight in singing, though none hears. Beside the singer, there is delight, there is delight. There is delight in praising, though the praiser sits alone, and though the praised far off from him, there is delight. All that came before us is just light, and so despite the pleas and pleasantries, we claim the night. Warmer climes give brighter plumage, stronger winds the breeze Alpine heights, you spread your wings and find what's right. The siren sings, the ship's at sea, though none hears. Beside the mast, there is delight, there is delight. There is delight in facing life, delight in cursing death, and though the body is at sea, there is delight. All that came before us is just light, and so despite the pleas and pleasantries, we take the night. Warmer climes give brighter plumage, stronger winds the breeze of alpine heights, tender strings and find what's right. There is delight in singing out your name, though you're not here beside the singer. There is delight, there is delight. There is delight in ties that bind, delight in knowing we are one, and though we are lost, there is delight. All that came before us is just light, and so despite your pleas and pleasantries, we forge the night. Warmer climes give brighter plumage, stronger winds the breeze of alpine heights, you play the strings to find what's right. play the strings to find what's right. You play the strings to find what's right.
The Great American Folk Show would like to thank John Doe, Julie Wolfson, Daniel Levitin, Sarah and Sean Watkins, and Madeline Camrude. Special thanks to Jim Brusseau, who wrote the short story Mickey the Dog, Sophia Wolfson in Los Angeles, California, Chrissy Tigerstrom in Austin, Texas, theme song and original instrumentation by Berkham Boys, additional instrumentation by Sean Watkins in Los Angeles, California, piano music by John Brusseau, our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. The Great American Folk Show was written and recorded by Tom Brusseau, produced and edited by Eric Detheridge and Bill Thomas. I'm Joe Wiegand. May you always find the sun until we meet again.
For more information about this program, please visit prairiepublic.org. On the next episode of The Great American Folk Show, Oscar-nominated actor John C. Reilly is back. Musicians Eleni Mandel and Letitia Van Zant and Andrea Baumgartner of Burn Baum's Restaurant in Fargo, North Dakota on matzo ball soup. Plus, notes from the Badlands by our very own Joe Wiegand. We'll see you then.
Kids in the yard, school in your lunchbox, you're studying so hard, your twin brother's crying. Busted his new glasses. Mom's gonna be mad. Probably scream for an hour. Put us in our room and won't give us dinner. School bus, I'm never ever late. If I could just hold you up for a minute, for this moment, if I could only. Till it starts to go away. We used to have some horses, and I used to throw the hay. My stepdad hurt somebody. And it all biceps. I won't have a break if I could just hold you up for a minute, for this moment, if I could only. Till it starts to go away. Till it starts to go away. Starts to go away.